Time to Run, a podcast series at PressHerald.com in which we're speaking with the various and sundry gubernatorial candidates in this June's primary and going beyond the politics and policy and finding out just who they are and where they came from and, as we say in Maine, how they got here from there. Our guest today is Betsy Sweet, Democratic candidate for governor. Welcome, Betsy.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be with you.
Good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
And we were just chatting about the fact that you can work in the State House for years and years, decades,
yes,
and be pretty much, you know, a household name to everybody up there. But you get out on the campaign trail, and all of a sudden you realize you have a lot of introductions to make. So introduce yourself. Let's go back to the very beginning here. Where are you from?
Yeah, so great. So I actually grew up outside of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And but I have to get the main thing in quickly. My grandparents lived out on North Haven Island.
Oh, okay.
My grandpa was a lobsterman out there, and my grandma lived out there. And luckily for us, my mom was a teacher. So literally at 3:02 on the last day of school, the car was packed. We got in the car, and we headed up to the island.
So you have that Maine DNA.
Yes. Okay. Well, we'd like to think so. I know, you know, it doesn't count really good.
Yeah. Now this was Vinyl Haven?
North Haven.
Oh, North Haven.
North Haven,
oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, it was a funny thing because back in the day, especially, there was a real division on the islands between summer people who came who had a lot of means and then, you know, island people who worked fishing and for the summer people and stuff. So we were betwixt and between because we didn't have means, but we certainly came up just for the summers to be with my grandparents. So
what would you do? I mean, would you?
So we were.
And
we
would you go out lobstering?
No. When we were little, my mother helped my grandfather lobster because he started to lose his eyesight. So my mother was his eyes on the boat and ran the boat and did everything. And then starting at 13, I had to work. And so I worked. My first job was as a cook for a couple at the age of 13 and a half, 14, and I cleaned and cooked for them. So there was a lot of funny stories about...
This was on the island?
Yeah, on the island, calling my father, who actually worked in a restaurant, and said, "Daddy, what? They want Eggs Benedict. What's that? I have no idea what that is." So anyway.
So you were a kid growing up outside of Philly, and what was your perception of Maine then? Was it the...
Oh, it was heaven.
Was it the... Oh, okay.
Oh,
was
Maine,
it
the wilderness? Maine was the place. I mean, everything I love about myself... And I love about who I am and about my life. I feel like was born and nurtured on North Haven, honestly. Like, you know, learning how to be outside. You know, my grandmother was the original self-taught naturalist. She taught us how to pet bumblebees, how to forage for food and land.
How do you pet a bumblebee?
So when a bumblebee's in a car, if you try and get it out, it gets all freaked out.
Yeah, and so do you.
Yeah. But, you know, this is the bumblebees, not yellow jackets. Yeah. But, you know, you can just pet it, and it really actually makes it calm, and then you can just escort it out the window very easily. So she was...
I never knew that.
She was the first naturalist. But we also, as little kids, I mean, we would be handed a rocker full of clams, and my grandmother would give us 2 drop lines and stick us in a rowboat and say, "Okay, we need 8 flounder for dinner. Go." And so my grandfather would go off lobstering, and my grandmother would go off doing her thing. And my sister and I, who's my sister's 2 years older than I think we were
one sibling?
No, I'm the youngest of 5.
5, okay.
But she and I were close in age, and they would send us out. And literally, like, we didn't come home without 8 flounder because we knew that was dinner. And so I don't think we had life jackets on. We'd row around, try and find, and we'd come back with flounder.
Wow.
So it was idyllic, and we were a necessary part of how the family worked.
And this was every summer, pretty much?
Every single summer my
whole
life,
really? Interesting.
Yeah.
So it must have been brutal. I can imagine spending a summer on North Haven, all due respect to Philadelphia, but then come late August, having to pile back onto
it was,
the ferry
and go it was
home.
Brutal. So as soon as I could, when I graduated from college, I was like, okay, how do I get to Maine? So that's
right,
what I did.
Right.
And
so let's back up, though, to Philadelphia. Philadelphia suburbs? City?
Yeah, we lived in a suburb, not on the main line, on the other side. Mm-hmm. My dad managed a restaurant. My mom was a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I'm youngest of 5 kids, but my parents had us in 2 groups, same parents, but I had 3 brothers together. My oldest brother is 18 years older than I am, and then they had a 13-year gap, and then my sister and I are 2 years apart.
Okay, we had that in my family too, the older kids and the younger kids.
It's
almost like 2 families.
Yeah, exactly. And my oldest brother was in college when I was born, and as a matter of fact, when he went to college, my mother was 9 months pregnant with me back in 1956, right? So when they got to the school to unload and put him in his dorm, my brother said to my mother, "Do not get out of that car. There is nobody else here with a mother who's 9 months pregnant." So my mother sat in the car while my father and my brother moved into his dorm room.
Right. So you're growing up, you've been very much involved in various forms of public service as an adult. Was that something that was, instilled?
Yeah.
And by whom?
Very much so. My parents were, first of all, my parents never missed an election. They were both registered Republicans.
Interesting.
But they, both always were very proud of the fact that, I remember my dad saying this as a young kid, I've never voted a straight ticket in my life, you know, and my mother too. My mother was all about the independents, and she was a big supporter of Adlai Stevenson, and you know what I mean? So, being of service was a big family value. So whether it was helping a neighbor when they were in trouble, or my dad was like one of the most kind, generous people. We didn't have much, but he always, when he saw a need, we went and helped. We gave what we could, you know.
Were you a religious family? Or?
It's funny. We were a church family. Mm-hmm. Like, I went to this church that was very important in my life. So social, I was in every choir. I was in the youth club and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I don't think of it as religious because it wasn't so about the religion. It was really about being part of a community.
The more social aspect of it.
And being social and being of service. And my dad, as we went along, ended up with a pretty bad drinking problem. I have a brother who died when I was 3 months old.
Oh.
He was 14. I was 3 months
old.
He had died of acute leukemia in four days.
Oh, my goodness.
Played basketball on Tuesday, got a nosebleed they couldn't stop, and he died on Saturday.
How old were you?
I was 3 months old.
Oh, so you have no
recollection. So I have no memory of him, but that pain certainly
lives. But that must be a pall that hung over the family for some time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they were really grief-stricken, and
my parents lost a child, too, and I know that it
Yeah, I think for my dad, he
brutal.
Could, yeah, and he was he was my dad's buddy. You know, how there's always a kid. He got up early with my dad. And so I think my dad, the way he dealt with his pain was to drink eventually. And my mom became very stoic, you know, so she was extraordinary woman. I mean, she was the get it done.
The rock.
You never say no. She was the rock. She, you know, when faced with a complex thing or something she knew nothing about, she never said, oh, I don't think I could do this. Or she just said, okay, how do we do this? You know, I remember the car breaking down or the boat breaking down in the middle of the bay. And I remember one time I was little and my grandfather had old inboard outboard, you know, and we took off the thing and the boat wasn't working. And so I was like, and so my mom started tinkering with the engine. And I said, Mom, do you know anything about what you're doing? She said, no. But this is logical. We'll figure it out. And sure enough, she put it back together and off we went. So that was what she brought to it. And so that was sort of what I think that was part of the benefit that came to it. It brought our family much closer together. Mm-hmm. We are now.
Well, that's good because that can go both ways.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it either brings you closer or it blows it up.
Apart.
You know.
Well, so now my immediate family that I consider my immediate family, there's 45 of us.
Wow.
And we are incredibly close, all the nieces and nephews and cousins. And we get together every 5 years for all together, but we all are in touch all the time. And
now you go through public high school, I assume?
Public, absolutely, public
and what
school.
College did you
I went to Colgate University in upstate New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was a bit of a hike.
Yeah, it was a bit of a hike, and it was also, I was the second class of women at Colgate,
really?
Which formed me a lot, and I don't know, I think part of it, the reason I went to Colgate was I had a best friend in high school who I admired incredibly, and she wanted to go there, and she said, but I don't think I can get in. And I thought, well, Jesus, I'm gonna try and see if I can get in, and so I did, and then when they said, well, it's the second class of women, I was like, okay, well, let's go make this equal, you know? And so I think there's a piece of me that when someone says you can't do it or you can't get it done, it's sort of, I go into
gear. Why not?
Right, exactly.
Were you nervous going
there? Oh, of course, yeah.
It must have been.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to this little place.
Running
it was
into
6 hours away.
Wall.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And one of my first political actions in college was protesting against the conditions in our locker room. I played field hockey. And the men had a brand new athletic complex with brand new lockers, and you know, and we were left with lockers that didn't shut, that smelled like men from, you know, 150 years of Colgate men, right? And I was like, okay, this will not do. So
that was your introduction to activism, huh?
Yep.
New locker room.
Yep.
Did you succeed?
Yes. Oh, yes. We succeeded. Yes, absolutely.
Great. What did you major in?
I majored in political science and international relations, and minored in Russian.
Oh. Okay.
Very helpful these days.
Yes, really. Russian studies.
Russian language.
The actual. So you speak Russian.
Neimanoga.
Wow. Well, this is an asset that might, you're right. You never know.
Yes.
You know, exactly. Trade missions.
Exactly. Yeah. Or hacking, or you know, right? I can tell what the hackers
exactly,
are saying.
Exactly. You can interpret manuscript, you know, wiretaps, yes, that exactly. kind of thing. So you get, you finish Colgate, and is that when you came to Maine, right there?
I actually went to Northern New Jersey first for a little bit, and I worked on the Equal Rights Amendment. Back then, they were trying to extend the time that states could vote on, you know, passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, which we still don't have in this country, which is amazing. But I canvassed. I went door to door talking about the Equal Rights Amendment and raising money from people to do this, which was the best political experience I ever had. Mm-hmm. You know, it was talking one-on-one with people about equality and what mattered and, you know, why don't we have this in the land of the free, you know, like all that stuff. So that was, I did that. And then I went to work for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom in Philadelphia for a year. Or no, 2 years, which was extraordinary. It was during the time of the nuclear arms race. The Cold War was at its height. And then I just said, what am I doing? I'm working 70 hours a week. I love my work. I love what I'm doing. But I need to get to Maine. And so one of my... Yeah.
So the pull, you felt the pull.
I was just like, I have to do this. And I thought the 70-hour-a-week thing was because I was living in a city.
Yeah.
And then I got to Maine and started working 70 hours a week.
Right. But it was different. What year did you come to Maine?
I came in Maine in 1983, end of 82.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, you've long been associated with Maine's LGBTQ community. You're really a leader, early leader of that. Tell me how that all...
Well, so I started at the women's lobby. And so women's issues were really my issues. And at that time, the women's lobby was very involved in getting equal rights into the Maine Human Rights Act, one of the few organizations. And so it was my job. It's like, okay, I'm supposed to do this. So I did it. And that time, the first time I worked on it, we got 27 votes in the House.
Ooh.
And I think maybe 2 in the Senate. And so then that, so that just became, you know, just fairness and equal treatment has been something that has just been ingrained in me and ingrained, you know, my parents ingrained it in me, even though they came from a different place. Everybody deserves an equal opportunity. So I started doing that for a long time. And so that's, and then it's just continued.
Yeah, and look at where we are now.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary.
It's interesting you mentioned the ERA versus equal rights for other groups. It's just something that really has kind of stuck.
Yeah.
When you came here, you didn't go back out to the island.
No, although I lived in Rockland. I lived in Rockland with my grandmother's best friend for a year.
Were your grandparents gone by then?
My grandparents were gone.
Okay.
They were gone. My mom and dad were here, and they were retiring, and so they spent a little longer on the island than, you know, than they used to be able to.
Right.
So that was really helpful. But I had, you know, my heart, and very many of my friends are still out on the island. And I commuted my first year from Rockland to Augusta in my
Route 17
in my 1968 Volkswagen that only had heat if I got underneath it and pried open the rusty flap. So I either had 100% heat all the time or none.
Mm-hmm. When I first came to Maine, I lived in Rockland and did that before they improved Route 17.
Yeah, me too.
I
mean, yeah,
it was just an awful drive.
Yeah, I mean, and then I went home to my grandmother's best friend, who was in her 80s, and you know, she kept one room heated, and then we had electric blankets in our bedrooms, and so, you know, I tried to help June out, and you know, it was, but I loved every minute of it.
Yeah. Now, what about your parents? Are they still with us?
Or no, they're gone. My dad died many years ago, and my mom died probably 20 years ago.
Oh, okay. So
yeah,
they
were older because I was the last of five.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
my mom
right.
was 43 when she had me.
Got it.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
And tell me about your children.
Oh, this is my favorite thing to talk about.
I figured it would be.
So I have three spectacular young women. And so Paley is my oldest, and she was she's 24, about to be 25. And she I had her, and she is just a wonderful ball of joy, smart, confident, all those things. She looks very much like me. So, and then she works for Oxfam, for the International Hunger Organization, but is quitting momentarily to go live in Tanzania for a year. So she's got that global thing. Mm-hmm. And then I have, I tried to have another baby and wasn't successful, and then ended up adopting twins from Cambodia 4 years later. And these young girls are, you know, it was such an interesting experience to go there and adopt them, to see these children who came from hunger, from difficult, really difficult circumstances, and to just be, try and be their rock, to help them be confident, to help them love themselves, understand. I think most adopted children have a black hole, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when you're given up by the person.
Big question marks.
Right. Yeah. I think they have a little bit less of that because they're twins. So they have a biological link that they've never lost. But so all my girls.
How did you find them? What was the process?
Yeah, it's a wonderful story. We met a friend who had a little girl from Cambodia, and she was like, I was like, oh, wow, that's exciting. And so she said, well, yes, but don't go through the agency I went through. When she was in Cambodia, she met this woman, Dr. Nancy Hendry, and she ran this agency called Adopt Cambodia from Maine. She was a physician. She goes there. She went there 2 weeks out of every month to actually take care of the kids. Mm-hmm. So she only dealt with 20 adoptions, you know, mm-hmm. a year. She was not a big adoption agency. And she was much more about making sure the kids got taken care of than making sure Americans have found kids to adopt, right?
So, yeah, because some of those things can get a little sketchy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So you traveled there?
So traveled there we brought Paley with us.
Who went with you?
So it was me, Paley, mm-hmm. and my partner at the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we went for 5.5 weeks, and then we got stuck there for a little extra long than people we thought, and then came home, and it was. You know, they didn't speak English. They had never been on a car, let alone on a plane.
Yeah.
You know, it was those beginning parts were really
hard.
Really hard.
You know, I mean, you think it's going to be all idyllic and,
oh, no.
You know, nirvana. But,
no, and I remember the social worker.
You got a
worker,
big challenge facing
the
you.
The social worker came back the first year, and after the first couple of weeks to check. And, you know, when they first came, they were so scared. They just did whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they got comfortable, and so they were like normal 2-year-olds, you know. And she said, oh, this is so great that they're, you know, they're being mad. And I was like, I liked it better when they were scared of us, you know. But So they're all now, they were all great students in school, leaders in their school, were service, extraordinary athletes, all three of them. One of my great joys was watching my little 5'1" Cambodian girls take basketball by storm. One of my girls made
really?
The all-state team at 5'1". She's 5'1".
A guard, I take
it. Oh, yeah, she's a guard. But watching the twin thing happen in soccer. And, you know, so they are just these funny, delicious. We call ourselves the Adventure Girls.
The Adventure Girls.
Uh-huh,
well, that's a great nickname for a family. I'm just curious, as you look back, we all kind of have these gauzy memories of childhood, and yours, I'm sure, are very centered on North Haven,
yes,
and Penobscot Bay and all that. And that sometimes instills in us this kind of, you know, nostalgia, you know, for you always wanted to go back to that. How do you compare the Maine that you're introducing yourself to right now with the Maine of your childhood dreams and memories?
You know, I would say that I think some of the dressing, outside dressing, has changed, but the things that I loved, that I loved as a kid, are still very present. And now, people care about each other. They're hardworking. They're willing to let you be whoever you are, as long as you're honest and kind and, you know, transparent. And they are just looking, they're hopeful and optimistic. And they're also, I think I felt so much about, so at home here always, because it's a get it done place. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't say I can't do that. They just get it done. They make it work. And that's how I grew up. And so to me, that's the get it done piece and the kindness, right? You know, I have a quick story. I don't know. But so as a single mom, so I had these two 2-year-olds and a 6-year-old,
mm-hmm.
and it's a scary thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's a hard thing, and I had full time work, right? So, and not many resources. But at night, like at 10:30 at night, right, I'd think, what would I do if something happened? Like, oh my God. Well, I have these neighbors from heaven who live not too far, Red Cross. I can see.
This is in Hollowell.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
And so I would always look, and I could see from my window into the bottom of their living room window, and I could see their feet. So it just meant a lot to me that their feet were there.
Mm-hmm.
And I never told them. I never, you know, and I just knew if anything happened to me or one of the kids and I needed to go to the hospital, whatever, I knew they would come help me.
Yeah.
Well, then they got new window treatments one day, and they were showing them off. And I said, well, clearly the neighbor was not taken into account with these window treatments. And they said, what are you talking about? I said, well, you don't know this, but I count on seeing your feet. It makes me feel so secure. And now I can't. And so for 18 years, my neighbors have kept that one window shade up 8 inches.
Oh, so you can see their feet.
So I can see their feet. And so that to me is everything about me.
Yeah.
We care about each other. We watch out for each other. And that has not changed that much.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm finding all over the state.
As you see more people with more feet in the window.
Yeah, lots of feet in the windows. Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a good note to end it on. We want to thank you, Betsy Sweet, for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good luck in the weeks ahead. You've got a very busy month.
Busy 40 days ahead, yeah. But we're excited.
But we look forward to it. And again, nice talking to you.
Thank you so much, Bill, for having me. It's good to see you.